Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday here on Mind Talk. I am pleased to introduce to you today Dr. Eric L. Johnson. He currently serves as the chief consultant with Strategies to Succeed, and he is also on the faculty of Virginia International University. He is a former chief of research publications for the United States Air Force Academy. And today, Dr. Johnson comes to us to discuss his book, 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride. Dr. Johnson, welcome to Mind Talk.
All right, and I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Now, Dr. Johnson, we are in Black History Month, and I am wondering what your thoughts are about the month, what your feelings are as a man of color, and whether or not you think 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride has any connection.
Wow, interesting question. A good question, by the way. I think it's totally relevant in the way that pride, the way I come at it in this book, really has to do with the idea that our strength and the meaningful strength and connection to the world come from our connection to other people, other things. And pride is an invitation to focus in on yourself, the things, focus on yourself. And as you think about Black, as I think about Black History Month and having looked at some of Carter G. Woodson's work, who was the father, of course, of Black History Month, and seeing that he wanted to use Black History Month to do two things. One, he wanted to use Black History Month as a mechanism to identify to place the African people on the clock of humanity, and to use that information as a compass to explore growth and progress. And so as we think about 10 Daily Aspects of Pride, one of the things I think is important is that where I suggest that pride disconnects us, that Black History Month is an opportunity for us to reconnect to those who came before us, our responsibility to those who follow us. And that's more than just about us. And indeed, pride is an endeavor that invites us to examine our connections to those things that are greater than ourselves. So I think there's a direct connection between the two.
Well, then let's talk a little bit more about 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride, and let's start with what your definition is of pride.
Sure. It's very simple. You know, for me, I think pride is an overestimation of one's ability, talents, skills, or importance. And so when I say overestimation, it means that when you overplay your importance in a particular situation, despite what many of us believe, if one of us was to not be here, the world keeps spinning.
I do not believe that for a minute.
Right. And so pride sometimes allows us to over-identify our particular role and the things that we say we care about. And when we over-identify our roles in those things that we say we care about, we lose sight of the thing that we say we care about. And so so pride for me is while most of the ways in which our life, we find meaning in our lives in our connections, pride is a disconnector.
Now, there are certainly those who would say pride in myself is actually the thing that I see as a strength. It's actually the thing that doesn't disconnect me. It actually connects me to others.
Right. Yeah, and I spent some time thinking about that because I think that in my experience, now that I've gone around the country talking about this book, because I've experienced quite a bit of resistance along those lines, and I think that mostly comes from people who have already succumbed to pride's very seductive appeal, right? And so we have to separate self-respect and self-concept from pride. Self-respect is an evaluation of our self-worth, and our self-concept is in part an evaluation of our connection to other people. Well, pride is not pride is part of the value that we assign. It's not self-respecting of itself. So having a positive self-image of oneself is not the same as being prideful.
I see. And you actually express concern about today's adolescents and young adults saying that their pride is a prideful vanity that seems to be commonplace.
And they accept it, right? I mean, accept it. I have a colleague I was talking with, and I have a colleague who does, her research is about the use of selfies in the development of identity, I should say, and so I'm not even sure what value of taking a picture of yourself doing nothing other than being yourself. I'm not even sure how we can connect that to any sort of development, but indeed we have, and that concerns me because I'm not sure that's a rule that leads us any place positive.
You know, it's interesting because actually selfies, taking pictures of self, has become sort of an industry in and of itself. There's equipment that you can use.
Absolutely, sure.
So you're a little bit concerned about that.
The overuse of it, right? So of course there is an element of self-respect, self-concept. I think it's important. Having a positive image of oneself is something we should all have. We should encourage that in everyone. But I am, like I said, that the things that are most meaningful for us, the things that help us provide the most meaning in our lives, are the things in which we are connected to. And I think pride is a disconnector. It only connects us to ourselves. And I don't know how long any one of us could survive if the only thing we were connected to was to ourselves.
That begs a comment that I'm not going to make in today's political climate, unless you choose to.
No. Right. Well, I think, in part, when I was writing Ten Deadly Aspects, particularly there's a chapter called Pride and Politics.
Yes.
It's Pride, Politics, and Society. I was actually writing it before what's happening now was happening. But to me, what's interesting is that exactly what I was trying to caution us against is exactly what we're doing now. I connect individuals, families, organizations, and nations as in some ways individual selves. A nation is a self in a way.
Okay.
An organization is a self in a way. A family is a self in a way. And when we use desired wants as a replacement for public policy, as a nation, as we see ourselves, when we use the wants and cravings without any consideration of the impact on the whole, then that is a form of cancer, right? The liver can't work at the expense of the lung. Right. So the liver and when the liver and the lung are working in opposition to one another, the self is in danger of its existence. And as I think about us as a nation, when we're thinking about something we want that's not a need, that something that we want at the expense of other parts of the whole, then the whole is in danger of not existing, and we work against ourselves. And I in the book I make an analogy to that, to something like that's cancerous.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about certainly today's world, and I'm thinking about the fact that this is Black History Month, mm-hmm. and I am wondering, it seems as though in today's world, people of color, of any color, just color, are being required by some to walk a different path, to have a different sense of themselves. I was told by someone who was actually out on the mall during inauguration day that there was a T-shirt somebody was wearing saying, "Send the N-word folks home." So there's a lot of stuff that's being said, and I would suggest being done specifically to people of color. Or at least focused on people of color. So I think about that, and now I got Black History Month, and how do I connect the two?
You know, those are. I mean, you see, I think in that question is some very important insights as to how we see our lives and how we see our reality. But now, I like to stop short of imposing what I think or judging another individual's walk. We all have to walk in a way that allows us to speak our truth and to allow our spirits to be free. That is a walk that, and no one can tell another how that walk works for them. So I like to stop short of that. But I do think it matters as we take this journey together, both as a nation, as a community, and then as families, as we take this walk together, that how we impact one another ultimately affects our own interest. And so as I think about specifically Black History Month, because that's something very important to me, as I think about Black History Month, as I said earlier, it was a mechanism that Dr. Woodson wanted us to use to allow us to tell the time of put ourselves on the clock of humanity. When he's writing and living in the 1920s is when he starts. In 1926 is when he starts Negro History Week. He's living in a time where he doesn't see any research or any ideas, a consciousness that's based out of a positive image of African identity, a people of African descent. And so he goes about the business of not just criticizing that, but writing that research and inviting other people to do it. And he spent the rest of his entire life, the next 15 years he spent in academe, and he left academe. He left academe because he thought he was better served in making a contribution ultimately to the nation by serving. He, in his mind, he thought by improving the circumstances of people of African descent, because our names have changed. We've been Negroes, we've been colored, we've been African, we've been Black, we've been African American, both with and without the hyphen. So that because the name has changed, but looking at people of African descent, as we seek to make their contribution known and give and enhance the ability to make contribution in the future, we ultimately serve the nation's interest. And so I thought that was, I don't know that I had understood the depth of what he was attempting to do. And so now for it to become, you know, Garrett E. Morgan doing the gas mask, or Madam C.J. Walker may or may not be the first Black woman millionaire, and how these facts, these racial platitudes have become the essence of Black History Month, to me, serves no one's interest. And the book I call this what I would call empty calories.
So it sounds like you're saying that I'm assuming I'm misunderstanding what you're saying, but it sounds like you're saying that a celebration of Black history, simply for the sake of celebrating Black history, is not necessarily useful. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what I'm saying. That it's not necessarily useful, because what we do is the celebration for the sake of the celebration doesn't connect it to anything that's happened in the past, anything we're doing now, and anything we're going to attempt to do in the future. And Black History Month is supposed to provide some navigational guidance to where we want to go, and we're not doing that simply. It's not the same as to be on the boat in the water and to talk about the water and the waves and how tall the waves are. Knowing how tall the waves are in the water does not help you determine the direction you need to go in to reach the destination you want to reach. Examining how many clouds are in the sky, right? These sort of facts are not what we need to do. So, indeed, that's indeed exactly the argument I'm making, and I think it's exactly the if we look at. We don't have to interpret Carter Woodson because he left us his work. He told us what he thought, and so if you look at what he thought, he didn't do that himself. He didn't do the Black trivia. That was never what Negro history was while he was alive. Now it didn't become a month until 1976, and he died in 1950. So that's a quarter century later. But yeah. That's exactly what I'm saying, and it concerns me that has now been accepted in such a way that we no longer even question it.
When you say Black trivia, what are you referring to?
Just like I said, so what I'm saying is when young children are in school, in elementary school, in middle school, and high school. School should be a place where we invite young people to find their purpose, to explore the meaning of what this life has in store for them, and explore the talents and the gifts that have been divinely given, have been divinely placed inside them. That's what we should, our educational process should be inviting them to find their best selves. In so much as if understanding that Garrett A. Morgan invented the gas mask, to the extent that that is inviting them to think about science, inviting them to think about oxygen, inviting them to think about earth and air and living, and to the extent that it does that, okay. But just understanding that fact does not do that.
I see what you're saying.
It doesn't. The fact alone has no connection to this child's life. And so once we leave the space of the time which we're talking about, that is forgotten. And I'm not sure it shouldn't be. If that's all we're going to do, remembering that is no more than remembering. It's no different than remembering any other trivial fact the things that we forget.
So,
or don't use.
How would you recast Black History Month? And again, I ask you that question as I am looking at a copy of The 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride. How would you recast it?
Yeah, see, that's an interesting question. I don't know that recast. I was just sort of, I don't think that I figured something out that nobody else saw before. I would simply invite us to do some self-reflection, some consideration, sober reflection, consideration about what it is we want to achieve. And so I have recently published an article in the Columbus African American News Journal called Black History Month, A River, Black History Month, The River of Black History Month, Past, Present, and Future, where we attempt to use this time as a space to understand where we're going, where we have been, and where we're going, and where we want to attend, and where we want to go. And so, for example, in this metaphor, and when I write about it, I talk about the trees and the rocks and the river that actually are used as natural filtration systems to clean the river's water. In the same way, our obstacles as a community, every obstacle, every challenge we've been forced to respond to makes us better. And understanding that better is the goal because the ultimate destination is a better day. Not examining the rocks and the trees, although we should understand the boulders and the water. We should understand all of that. But the goal is to move us toward a better day and never lose sight of that goal. So I don't know that I would recast Black History Month. I would just invite us to remember why we should be doing this in the first place. This is not some exercise and, like I said, some exercise in just feeling good. This is an exercise to determine what it means to be better, and that's not the same thing.
So it sounds like you're saying that one of the reasons that pride is not useful is because it leaves you on the surface.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
Okay.
And so I make the distinction in the book, the difference between what I used the example earlier, empty calories. And how do you, the calories from a chocolate bar and the calories from a bell pepper are not the same. And there is some period of time that you can live off the calories of the chocolate bar, but it has consequences. And it ultimately works against the very self that it's attempting to feed.
From that perspective, you're saying that being aware, being more aware, more conscious, more present in a lot of ways is the useful place to be and to grow in.
Being aware in the way that invites you to explore what it means to be your best self. And your best self means our best self as individuals, our best self as communities, our best self as a nation, our best self as organization, but exploring what it means to be the best self, what our best possible self represents in our development. That's the distinction I want us to, and that's the reason we don't do that, because that's harder to do.
Absolutely.
Very few of us can claim that we know how to do that. So, you know, those of us who call ourselves experts, we become less relevant when we give the work to the people will we give the work back to the people, and our job just becomes to facilitate. See, then the expert's role gets reduced, which it should be in the first place. And so that's what I'm suggesting. Gotcha. I'm suggesting that when we do that, it's explore in the context of what it means to be our best possible self, and what being our best possible self, how that relates to where we're going and why we think it's important to get there in the first place.
Dr. Eric Johnson, author of 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Dr. Johnson, you say that pride is a spiritual enemy. What do you mean by that?
So, as we think about a spiritual enemy, is that the word spirit has many different meanings to different people. For some people, spirit and religion are circles that overlap one another. For some people, there is spirituality, and then there's religion, and they're two separate things. And then for some people, spirituality and religion are like a Venn diagram where two circles have a section where they intersect. Well, it doesn't matter which one of those perspectives that one might come at this discussion. Where in all of them, and spirit invites us to examine what it means beyond our own self-interest, what this life means beyond our own self-interest. It invites us to examine that which is greater than ourselves. Right, so that's what spirit is. No matter which one of those philosophical approaches, spiritual approaches, religious approaches that you come at the subject from, in essence, in all of those approaches, we are invited to examine how we fit into the bigger picture. Well, pride is a threat because pride invites us to examine us and the importance of our individuality. And while I think we are indispensable, irreplaceable beings of light, that's what we are. We're beings of light. And so pride is a spiritual enemy because it's a threat to our understanding. If an enemy is a potential threat or foe, pride is a threat because of what it invites, because of the trouble it invites to a spiritual investigation. Pride invites us to look at ourselves, and spirit invites us to look at almost everything else.
You also say that pride and envy, perhaps they are in the same basket, and perhaps they both do the same same harm.
Yeah, I think that's a chapter I call "Pride: A Cheap Supporter of Envy," and where envy is, and in the book I make a distinction between envy and jealousy, because I realize that lots of people use envy and jealousy as interchangeably. But they're not. And so envy is the notion that we covet something externally. We covet something outside ourselves. It could be possessions. It could be what qualities we see in other individuals. Well, so pride and envy are related in that pride gives us permission to think we should have those qualities or that we should have those things. Pride tells us why we should have it, but pride does not tell us why we should earn it.
I see. So,
and so if, that's why pride becomes a supporter of envy, because it supports envy's nonsense and it gives it justification.
So if I'm envious of my neighbor's car, mm-hmm. with pride, I'm just envious of my neighbor's car, and I can't figure out why I don't have it.
But pride will tell you to go get that car. Doesn't matter if you can afford it. Doesn't matter if you should have it. Doesn't matter if it fits inside your life. Pride will tell you why you should have that, that you should get the car. But pride doesn't tell you how you should. So for some folks, they steal the car.
Gotcha.
Other folks go buy the car when they can't afford it. Other folks go buy the car when it doesn't even fit inside their needs. So that's why pride supports envy, because it, the things that envy wants, pride gives it justification to go get it by any means necessary.
So my neighbor has this car, and there's no reason why I shouldn't have it too. I'm going to go get it.
Now, what's powerful to me about envy is you picked up on the material accumulation of it. What's more interesting to me about envy is when we envy someone else's joy, someone else's love, someone else's, when we envy qualities about an individual where we can't just go get it. We can't go steal it. We can't go buy it. We can't go coerce it. So then envy turns its attention not how I get it, but how I take it from someone else. How do I take your joy? How do I make these people love you less? And that is a circumstance that presents many challenges that border on dangers.
So is it that I'm concerned, if I'm envious of something, I'm concerned about me having it and the other person not? Or am I just concerned about me having it?
Well, if we're talking about a material thing, it could be either or it could be both. So you could wonder why somebody has this thing that you want: car, house, money, job, and why they have it. And you could wonder why you don't. And those, while they're being born out of the same energy, they invite us to do different things. But there's not a lot we can do when we're coveting someone's qualities.
Right.
We're coveting someone that love someone has, you know, or the respect someone has. So the only thing we can do now is we can't go get that. We just got to take it from them.
And, you know, what's interesting about that process is for those whose self-esteem is in a challenging place, they will then turn what's going on with the person they envy into a negative so that they can
Absolutely.
Feel better and be better.
And that is, and so one of the points I make in the book, that envy is really a result of our own insecurities, our own vulnerabilities, of which we all have. None of us exist in this life without insecurities and vulnerabilities. And admitting to them takes away some of the strength. And that's what I write about. You give them less power when we're willing to own them. But as long as we deny them, it gives them the power to occupy far more of our self than they should.
Because we're really unconscious about it, so it can just go all over the place.
Go all over the place, absolutely.
Okay.
But when we own them, and so in the book, in that specific chapter, I ask the reader to think about, what is it that I fear? And what is it that my fears invite me to do?
That's a hard question.
That's a serious question. I mean, that's the difference between the laundry list of facts and the doing the work to make us better. How do I use the work of Garrett A. Morgan's gas mask work to make me a better math person, a better scientist? I'm reading a book now called about FDR's first 100 days, and one of FDR's the person who's ultimately going to become Secretary of Agriculture, when he's a kid, he's in Iowa, and Booker T. Washington is working at Iowa State, and Booker T. Washington shows this young man how to, you know, he's talking about, he's doing all kind of botanist activities with him, and as a result of his connection with Booker T. Washington, and Booker T. Washington showing him about botany and what it means and how it works with the earth, this young man takes that information and he ultimately ascends to Secretary of Agriculture.
I see.
That's what we need to be doing. And I didn't even know that. And so this book I'm reading had nothing to do with Black History Month. Nobody black wrote it. I'm just reading a book about FDR's first 100 days because I'm better trying to understand President Trump's first 100 days. And so I'm using that to grow from it. And then this big fact about Booker T. Washington pops up, and it's just fascinating to me.
It absolutely is. And if you can help explain Trump's first 100 days, I personally would be grateful.
Yeah, I think we all would, right? But what's interesting to me, though, is that it is not as much of the challenges that many of the things that were presenting themselves as challenges during FDR's first 100 days are also playing out in FDR's first 100 days. I'll give you an example, just a quick one. So as FDR has remembered historically, most of his historical legacy has to do with the New Deal, which is FDR's first presidency.
Okay.
But when he came into office, his entire agenda was to reduce the federal budget.
Okay.
So he was telling his department heads, you got to cut your budget by a third or 25%. And so he would negotiate with each department head because some of them thought he was asking for too much. But he was trying to cut the federal budget. He was not trying to grow it. And I think that has completely been lost in his historical legacy.
Interesting.
About the first 100 days. And what that means and how that played out to how we ultimately remember his legacy. I thought that was interesting that because I didn't know that his goal was to cut federal spending, because that meant, because that to me, that was contradictory to the relief programs that he did, the public works programs that he did. I didn't know that the first cabinet member, the first woman cabinet member in the history of the country was Perkins, Secretary of Labor Perkins, who was the first woman to ever become a cabinet member under FDR's in his first administration. I just think that in my book, where I talk about intellectual growth, it's not just about what we know and what we don't know. Intellectual growth is about the willingness to expand one's capacity, and as we seek to be more than what we are, in those spaces, we learn to become what we could be.
What it also underscores, at least for me, is that there is value to acquiring knowledge and information from many different sources.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely. And so, I mean, I tend to stay within my reading typically has a specific agenda, but it's just interesting to me that when we commit ourselves, because I write in the book that when one intellectual, I mean, I think the chapter is called Pride, the Inverse of Intellect, where intellect is this idea that we build our capacity to grow, and we examine where we are and where we want to be and how we develop a map to connect the two. In that same way, Black History Month should be that same space where we examine where we are and where we want to be, and how do we use what's come before us to help us develop this map to connect the two. And so individually for me, I have to commit myself to building my capacity in all the ways that my imagination will allow me to do that. And pride can sometimes, when your imagination invites you to think about what is, pride will invite you to settle for what is.
Tell us your definition of jealousy.
So jealousy primarily is the idea of jealousy is when one is concerned about losing the affection of one person to another. Having jealousy is the concern of having lost it, or jealousy is the resentment of having lost it, or the concern for losing it, losing the affection of another. Envy is about the coveting of something that we see that we want.
Okay, so envy is theoretically a thing. Jealousy is a person.
It targets a person. It's okay. About a person. Right, okay. Yes. Okay. Absolutely. I wish I could have said that simply in my book.
Well, I'll let you do a second run, and then you can quote me.
Oh, stop it. Yeah, but seriously, that's indeed the... And I make the distinction because, like I said, lots of people use jealousy and envy interchangeably or not, and when I pulled it apart, then it really invited me to think about how much of our lives is about getting something we see other people have. And in the chapter on envy, I think in general that's a good thing. When we're around doctors, we want to become doctors. When we're around lawyers, we want to become lawyers. When we're around teachers, we want to become. I think that 95% of the time is a good thing that we want to, that we set goals based off the aspirations we develop from the world we're exposed to. So the question becomes, how does that natural positive phenomenon spasm into something that we call envy?
I see.
Right. And that's what that chapter is about, examining our own, because it's our own insecurities, our own vulnerabilities that cause that spasm to occur. And there is our work. Our work is not in what we see. The work is what we experience in our own hearts and minds.
For those who are listening, who have thought about themselves and what they want to do with their lives, and then they allow themselves to be stuck by whatever the world says around them is true about them, what do you want them to think about?
That is such a great question. All of my work, you know, I've now written 3 books, and I have a 4th book coming out at the end of the year. All of my work is exactly about that question, about none of us are arrested by the perceptions of the world around us. All of us have the right and the ability to live beyond any previously conceived perception of self. And so as you ask me that question, one of the things I want to invite your audience and any reader of any of my books, we're talking about 10 Deadly Aspects now, but any of my books, is to understand that there is a difference between who we are and who we could be, translate to our best possible selves, and the only thing that moves us from one place to the other is our own effort. We are the thing that keeps us from getting there, and we are the thing that keeps us from getting there, and we are the thing that provides the vehicle to go there. But it's all within us. We are not housed by anyone else's preconceived notions of what they think we could be or should be. We can all live beyond that, and that's an important notion. And I think that's in a world driven by accumulation of material things and materialism, consumption, competition, vanity, in a world that where these things are not, I mean, you can see that stuff in the church. That in a world where that becomes such commonplace, it's hard to do the work I'm suggesting, which is why I think most of us don't do it. It's easier to not do it.
Well, you know, for somebody listening who says, okay, I hear Dr. Johnson and that's all good, but for me personally, I really don't have any options. I really am stuck where I am. What do you say to that person who was consciously rejecting your assertion that what goes on in your life is really your choice?
Yeah. Now, what I don't want to do is convolute this conversation where we don't acknowledge that white supremacy is a real thing,
okay,
that sexism is a real thing, that classism is a real thing, that these are forces that actively operate against individuals.
Okay.
So I don't want this conversation to in any way suggest that I don't think those things are true, because I spent my life responding to those things. But having said that, knowing that that's true, that what I don't want us to do is to connect our self-worth to the accumulation of the things that serve to the external things that serve to suggest success to someone else.
I see. Okay, gotcha.
I don't want to limit the potential of anyone's best possible self to be whether or not they do drive the BMW or the Mercedes or the Lexus or live in the big house. I don't want that to define what you think is success. What I'm inviting that person that you're talking about, because in some ways I am that person. I have been that person. That I want that person to evaluate what it is they see as an important way of being in the world. Inviting them to examine what it is they want to be and what it is they choose to leave behind.
Gotcha.
In that effort to explore our own being, we are not confined by white supremacy or racism or sexism or classism or any other form of discrimination.
Right.
In that effort to be what it is we think our best possible selves is, the only obstacles that exist for that are inside our own hearts and minds. And so I would make the distinction, as you said, to that person, because I would never suggest. I run a men's group. And I have lots of, these men are
coming at
this conversation from.
Let me interrupt you, Dr. Johnson, because we need to take a break. But when we come back, I'd like for you to tell us a little bit about the men's group that you run and what you're learning about yourself and others in that group. Folks, we will be right back. You're listening to Mind Talk. I'm Pamela Brewer. Dr. Johnson, before the break, you began to talk about a men's group that you're involved in. Can you tell us a little bit more about the men's group?
Yeah, so what I've tried to do is bring together a collection of men from a variety of backgrounds, different religious backgrounds. We have some men who are Muslim, some men who are Christian, some men who are not religious in the traditional sense at all, and then men who think very little of the impact of spirit on their lives. And we've got across race and ethnicity. And so one of the things our motto is in building the capacity, improving the capacity of men to be their best possible selves. And so for me, it's a place where because most of the things I do in my life is things that I'm responsible for, I'm a coordinator, I'm in charge of. But this is a space where I go where I attempt to drink myself. And so it's a really an invitation of men to be in space which can be vulnerable. And men, when we use words like love and spirit, which is a word that men almost never use talking to each other. Unless, you know, we say we love something, but to talk about love as a concept and the impact of love on our lives, it invites something that for some men are uncomfortable. And even the men in our group were uncomfortable with that concept at first. And so this group is just a space that allows men to explore what they could be if they were their best possible selves. What might that look like?
And what do you see as, if there is, a core challenge that exists within the group to accomplish that goal?
Well, we had a subject where we talked about our understanding of masculinity and our understanding of manhood. And one of the things that I'm finding is that I think people think that men have a far more common understanding of that than men actually do. The men in this room see those things as very different from each other. But the notion of masculinity and what we think that is, and how often many men connect notions of strength that they perceive to be strength to masculinity, and how they invariably suggest that then femininity is the opposite of that.
Interesting.
And what that might mean to our understanding of ourselves and the understanding of the other people in which we share space. So what happens when they have this understanding about masculinity? How do I evaluate the men who fall outside of that?
And the women
who fall inside.
Yeah, it sounds like it's a very concrete either or kind of concept about men and women, which is so limiting.
And so again, I work hard not to impose my understanding on other folks. I think that we have to be in this world in a way that matches our walk. And so the point of this group and of any men's group should be to not tell us how to walk, but to invite us to understand why we walk the way we do.
Okay. It sounds like it has all the earmarks of an extraordinary group.
The jury's law now, but I'm hoping at least for the people who show up, every month they leave with something that they didn't have when they showed up.
You know, it's interesting because more and more, I mean, again, group is also something that group therapy, support groups, whatever you want to call them, and of course they're all different, but that used to be seen as the thing that women did. And more and more we're hearing about men's groups. And personally, I think it's wonderful.
Right. And now the difference between this group is that I've run men's groups before, and I've intentionally not run men's groups that were connected to churches, because there's a group of men that you can't get to if you come at them through church affiliation.
Okay.
But it's interesting because the opposite is true, too. There are men who won't come to something that's not church affiliated. And one of the things I was saying to the men is that just because we're not church affiliated doesn't mean you can't bring it with you. You can bring anything you think should be here. So there's no reason to not attend because we're not a church affiliated. If you bring that with you, then it's in the group. And so I think that's interesting that sometimes we make these arbitrary decisions about things that I'm not sure matter nearly as much as we like to claim they do.
And, you know, what I also hear is that when you are telling your group members, if you bring it in, then it's in the group, you're telling them in very profound ways that who they are is important and it's profound and it has an impact. And I would suggest that so many of us don't recognize the importance of ourselves in the world and in our lives as well as in the lives of other people.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's why I wrote Pride, because certainly, let me say it to you this way. Do you know how prideful you have to be to write a book about pride?
I'm not commenting.
Right. You know, do you know the kind of pride it takes to do that? And so I write from this perspective that all we have to decide to do is that we want to be better. And then we'll begin to walk differently and get us spaces that invite us to do that. But we have to decide that it's the commitment that's necessary, not the journey. The journey will begin to develop itself. And so 10 Daily Aspects of Pride for me was the beginning of a different aspect of my own journey, because it requires me to all of the things that I'm inviting the reader to confront in this book are things that I have to confront myself every day. And for me, it's particularly powerful because I'm affirmed in a way that's particularly intoxicating. People have been calling me doctor for a long time. I got all these degrees. I've done all these things. And I get affirmed in a way that sometimes can suggest to my mind that, you know, maybe I might be more important than the dude on the corner. Mm-hmm. But indeed, I'm not. And all I need to do is there's a point in the book, I think it's in the chapter called Love, Pride, an Archenemy of Love. And in that chapter, it asks the reader to suggest, every time you upset with somebody that you're connected to, that you claim you love, all you need to do is remember all the reasons that disconnection from you is a worthy option. Let me say it again.
Okay.
Examine all the reasons that disconnection from you are a worthy option. When you seriously bring that into your awareness, your evaluation, your judgment of other people tends to be decreased.
Interesting.
When you see all the reasons that it makes sense for somebody to stay out from around you.
And when you get that, it kind of changes things.
then the things that you want to talk about other people become a little less important, because you go, well, in order to be around me, you got to deal with this.
Right.
Whatever that happens to be. And so for me, that has become that's my calling, that's my work. And so I'm inviting us to meet, and myself included. I'm never not in, when I say us, that's why I say us, because I'm including myself. I'm inviting us. I'm not interested in telling people what that should be. What I'm interested in is participating in the process where we're all better because we engaged in it.
And so, again, better is defined by the individual.
By you.
Right.
Right. I'm not interested in it. I'm not as much interested in imposing. Now, there are times in the group where men are, where sometimes in my men's group, there are times where I feel like there is something, there is an idea being promoted I think is clearly sexist or discriminatory. I do confront those ideas. I do confront them. But I confront them in a way that that invites the speaker to see that other people might see that differently. And there is, how do you evaluate this data pattern in that thing you just said?
Now, certainly there, particularly now, I would suggest, but actually for perhaps as long as we've been around and been human,
right.
That, you know, there are folks who will say, well, I am evaluating women, fill in the blanks, and here's my proof that women are fill in the blanks. And mm-hmm. And the other folks in the room, not only are they not necessarily questioning that, but they're supporting that. And so mm-hmm. the focus is on the other and not on themselves.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what I say I confront that. I engage that by giving this data set, but then inviting, what about you do you think helps you see that? Because in the world, there's a possibility to see almost anything. Almost everything that can exist does in some way. Almost everything that can. And we only get to see some fraction of what exists. And we only imagine just a slightly bigger fraction of that, of what actually exists. There's all kinds of things that exist that we're not even aware of. I just mentioned to you that the first woman cabinet member was an FDR. I've studied this stuff for a long time, race, class, gender, discrimination. That was one that escaped me, right? And so there's always all these things that actually exist that we're not aware of. And like I said, our imagination gets us to slightly more than that. The question becomes, how do we operate with such certainty when there's so much that's unknown? So when you make claims about stuff that you don't know, it doesn't tell us what you know. It just invites us to see some aspect of who you are.
And it may also, in fact, tell us what you don't know.
Right. That's obvious that it does that.
Right.
But more importantly, it gives us some aspect of who you are. Because when we make those claims, we think we're showing our knowledge, but we're actually revealing some pieces of ourselves and our own insecurities. Right. And so that has been a very interesting space for our men's group. For my men's group, when we enter into that space where we have to come to terms with how our own identity informs what we say we believe and informs what we claim we know. How much of that comes from our identity and not some facts that we can identify.
It is often a real challenge when folks recognize the difference between who they say they are and the way that they behave, what they say they want and what they actually, you know, opt to try to access. Huge difference.
No question. And none of us are the exception. I mean, this is stuff I have to work on every day. Every single day I have to work on this. And the times I go back and read my own books to explore my own thinking. Because I know that in my first book, Beyond Self-Help, there are things I wrote in that book that aren't necessarily things that I consciously think all the time, and I have to be reminded. There's a section in my book, Beyond Self-Help, where it invites the reader to think about, so we got these things when we're aware, when we're growing. We got these things that we're aware of that we want to change, right? We got these things that we're aware of that we want to change. And then there's things that we need to change that we don't know. But here is what I think is fascinating. There are things about us that we know we should change, but we're willing to live with. And it's those things I think are very interesting. The things you know that are not okay, but you do them anyway.
That sounds like a conversation for yet another day.
Indeed.
Because that can be huge.
Absolutely. And so that's why I say to you that this is work I have to do every day. I'm no better at it than anybody else. I have just committed myself to the journey and all the mistakes that go with it.
Throughout our conversation today, you have been referring directly and indirectly to the need to do work within yourself. And you know, there's a couple of folks at least who are saying, I'm tired of working. I don't want to do any work. What do you say to them?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, in fact, I just had this conversation with somebody. I said, the person who's looking for life without the work is actually looking for the fairy tale. Because in life, the adversity is life itself. We cannot experience life without adversity. Without adversity, it's not real. And so I say to that person, what you're looking for is an escape. And I'm okay if that's what you want. I just need you to say that's what you want. Be clear about what you mean. Because the work is real. Because as we all know, that people say that tomorrow isn't promised. Later on today is not promised. One of us knows somebody. You go, I just talked to her. I just talked to him.
Right.
Yeah. I got an uncle who got on the, I may have told you a story. I got an uncle who got on the bus with groceries. So you know how many plans he had about them groceries?
Of course.
He gonna put the honey in that cabinet. He gonna make them this, and never left that bus alive. So we talk about, you know, like I said, you know, tomorrow not being promised. Later on today is not promised. So the person who's looking for life without the work, you're looking for the fantasy, and I'm okay if that's what you want. I ain't here to judge it, right? I just think that if that's what you want, you have to own it. Because that's not real. The adversity is in part the way our character is defined. We are defined by the way we respond to the challenges that life presents to each one of us.
Dr. Eric L. Johnson, author of 10 Deadly Aspects of Pride, is there a website where folks can go to?
Absolutely. So they can check out more about information about all the things we do. I'm involved with a big fatherhood initiative going around the country now. But the website is Strategies to Succeed, strategies2succeed.biz. Strategies2succeed.biz. And then, of course, we've got a Strategies to Succeed Facebook page. And we've got, I think, Dr. Eric Johnson is our Instagram account. But, you know, it's all kinds of ways in which people can be involved. And I'm not just inviting people to get to examine more information about our books. I'm inviting people to explore what they think it means to be their best possible self. And if that includes us, that's I'm grateful. But if it doesn't, I'm far more interested in you asking yourself those questions.
Dr. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us today on this edition of Mind Talk.